Bakar's spiritual advancement, how it has a way to weaken our physical state, our physical status, our health, our well-being, and how it affects our mind. So today I just said we would have a little sort of interactive dialogue, mostly just questions and answers, because I spoke quite long yesterday, and also it's kind of hot in here. And so we only took about one or two questions. We try to ask the people who had further questions if they would come back. But what I'll do, I'll just kind of summarize, since maybe a few of you weren't here yesterday, just some of the things that we discussed. First, we were looking at the fact that the world is developing into a culture of fear. And we discussed, from the Vedic perspective, what is called adhyatmic, adhibhautik, adhibhutik, fears from the mind, fears from other living entities, fears from devas or demigods or from the environment. We looked at that the body and material life has to do with eating, mating, fearing, and eating, mating, sleeping, and fearing. Sometimes we say eating, mating, sleeping, and descending. And so Srila Prabhupada explains how the most difficult to overcome is actually fearing. Because even with eating, sleeping, mating, etc., there's always some anxiety in doing these things, or some anxiety in what's going to come to us in the future. And so all of those things, fear is constantly permeating. And Bhagavatam explains that the material world is comprised of separated energies of the Lord, of Krishna, and that one of these major ingredients that makes up the material world is bhaya, or fear. So Bhagavatam also explains that one is supposed to be akuto bhaya, and that is doubtless and fearless. That as we progress spiritually, we become free of doubt, free of fear. It doesn't mean we become harsh or insensitive. It doesn't mean that we go, you know, into denial. But it's the opposite. That we're clear, and so we are careful about acting in the right way and not being intimidated to do what is necessary, especially to live according to what is necessary. Also, Bhagavatam explains that fear has a lot to do with body conception, because most fears are in relationship to something happening or not happening to the body. Fear has to do with a lack of dependence on Krishna, where one is so much trying to do things based on themselves, their own intelligence, their own resources, finances, energies, etc. Bhagavatam explains that to the degree that we are God conscious, then there's less and less fear. Doesn't mean that, you know, there's denial of problems, or it doesn't mean that there is no challenges or complications. But one doesn't get so much into worrying. Also, we understand that God doesn't want us to be in fear. No more than you want, you know, your little child, or no more than you want your husband or wife, or even a friend, to be in fear. It gives you anxiety when you see that they're experiencing fear. You want to do something, you know. Your little child is being very disturbed. And so you want to help him to understand that you're here, that what he's overworked up about, that it's not actually, you know, so necessary. And sometimes you help them to see that, you know, that it's even irrational. And so What did it say about the supreme, loving, worshipful Godhead or the divine couple that they are not trying to put us in a arrangement for fear or happy and enjoying the fact that we are afraid or uncertain? Someone would be considered to be cruel or unkind if that is their mood. Is this normal? Someone is considered to be insensitive if they enjoy watching somebody suffer, or they're putting someone in a situation where they're struggling. They're putting someone in a situation where they're anxious. You know, people do that. People do sometimes, just like someone knows that you're afraid of spiders, or someone knows that you're afraid of whatever, dogs, anything. And so there are times when an individual doesn't have your best interest in mind, and because of that, they do something to put you in anxiety. They take a spider or a snake or a worm or something and throw it on you. And they're happy watching you, you know, go through this tantrum. And so when we think that our anxieties and our problems is not being noticed or even being encouraged or even being brought on by God, that's like thinking that God is cruel, that He wants to see us in such moods of anxiousness. But we understand it's the opposite. They want to see us secure, want to see us happy. Now, how do we deal with that seemingly contradiction? How can the Supreme Lord want to see us happy, secure, at the same time be controlling all things, and then let these things come upon us that in fact does put us in anxiety? Seems almost like a contradiction. How does God, who's supposed to be all loving, all kind, who's all protective, allow us to be in so many situations where we seem to be unprotected, uncared for, even under assault? Why does God, who is all loving, allow us to be so bewildered and afraid? Well, obviously, it is not the Lord arranging such, but honoring our free will. And with our misuse of free will, we avoid accepting the guidance, the clarity, the protection that's there. The Father is there constantly consoling the child. At the same time, the child is choosing not to hear His words and accept them. And so the kid is in anxiety and crying and afraid. Not that the Father is enjoying it or putting the child in such a situation, but is in anxiety. So we produce the situations of anxiety, of what we do or what we don't do. We put people in anxiety, right? Is that right? So we all have our free will to do or not to do, or how we do, and then there's all kind of consequences. So if we understand that, if we do like a quick 5-minute summary of yesterday. So we're looking at is the fact that eating, mating, sleeping, and fearing, that the most difficult is fearing. Eating is there, just as we understand that the living entity is engaged in constantly trying to somehow get some gratification. Anamoya, pranamoya, ganamoya. That first, the basic life expression is how to find something to eat. So if that's a little satisfied, how to get some protection so one can keep on making arrangements so they can keep getting something to eat. When that is satisfied, then there is some mental gymnastics, some intellectual, ponderance. And then from that, there's a desire to understand things deeper, to go beyond just the immediate needs or the immediate want. So we look at the fact that there is two basic things. We say karma or prema. But really, there's only prema, there's only love. When it comes in contact with the three modes of material nature, it becomes karma. Now, it is karma or fear. Or we can say there's only love and fear. Or fear is all those things that take away from being loving or from understanding and identifying with one's actual identity. Fear has to deal with one of the major ingredients that maintains the material world. Because fear is connected with enviousness, connected with lust, it's connected with greed, it's connected with all of these enemies of the mind. We say karma, krodha, lobha, mohan, matsuya. All of these things are connected with fear, that is having a platform for false ego, and now so many things are happening. So when we look at all that, we see, oh, this is where love is so powerful. Because where love is accessed, then it pushes fear out the way. Or where fear is dominant, it pushes love out the way. You can't really love someone who you're afraid of. Not really. You can't really have loving associations and relationships where there is fear. You can't even really love God where there is fear. Even though sometimes we have this conception that you must fear God. Well, fear can encourage you to do something mechanically. It can encourage you to use your body and a little bit of your mind to use your body. But fear cannot capture your heart. And bhakti is about the heart connection. It is about the highest level of identity, soul to soul. And so we understand that as we talk about mind, body, heart, that closest expression to who we really are goes beyond our acculturation. That's what, based on our body, and even based on our mind. Even the way we think has to do with so much of how we perceive things, which is in relationship to our language, our race, the part of the world we're in, this life and previous life experiences. But the soul is eternal while all these other things are going on. So, it is a great aspect of Maya and Maya's workers to have people in fear as much as possible so that one will not be able to access their full authentic self. Demons are always trying to create this environment of taking away from love and honoring fear, aggression. Because when you're afraid, you're what? You retreat or you attack. You're afraid, so sometimes you attack someone because you think they're going to attack you. Or you're afraid and you run away from situations. So imagine an environment where everybody's attacking, posturing, running away, running at. This is the demon, what the demons in love. Kali is very excited to see. Oh, now everyone's so preoccupied as they are either directly assaulting each other or they are making plans to assault. This is what the material world is. It's different people wounding and hurting others, different people experiencing their own wounds and own hurts, all based on what has been put into motion, this whole combative attacking mentality and lifestyle. So the agents of Krishna, the agents of divinity, are then constantly trying to see how they can bring in the knowledge and the activities and the culture of real love, peace, which has to do with honoring one's real existence. So this is a game that's going on, or a war that's going on. And most people, what can they do? They just get captured by the general atmosphere, and they posture, and either they're shut down because of fear, so they never really, really give themselves in terms of real love to anybody. Doesn't matter who it is. And failure cannot give to Krishna, give to God, because they give to the Lord based on how they are giving and adding up and practicing, and then one day they have all of this love that is connected with God. And once they have all this love built up, as they have become so loving and divine, there's no reason at all for such person to be in the prison house that's basically geared for people who are fearing and fighting on different fronts. So this is our practice. in our bhajan, in our kirtan, our sadhana, sravanam, kirtanam, all of these things are designed to help us actually to give up fear that causes us to engage in different kind of sense gratification. Because our soul is pure. Original Sarupa is a pure state. And the Lord wants us back. So then what's happening? What's happening? Somebody's calling you, but you're not coming. Somebody's calling us, but we haven't came yet. So what's going on? It means we are afraid. Because we're afraid, we are sometimes hearing the call, sometimes not accepting it, sometimes wondering, maybe they're calling someone else. They're preoccupied, and so therefore, even though the call is there, you're not responding. So in one sense, this is the whole of spiritual life. The call is there, and we're finding ways to refuse it. And so we refuse it by different things connected with false ego, fear, all the same stuff. All karma. The love means the call, loving call is there, and now we're responding. So the things that we talked about, I'll summarize in 5 minutes and we'll take questions. We talked a little bit about Adi Devik and Bhautik. So we asked you to look at some of the fears that you have within your own mind, and we discussed some of those. And then we looked at fears from the day with the fears from the environment, and we discussed a set of those that you shared with us. Then we looked at fears that we have from others, showing that practically anything that we do, there's this unfortunate element of fear that just keeps jumping out at us. We asked you to think about, some of you who are here, we asked you to look at what is your greatest fear. You had to categorize one thing you consider to be your number one fear. Something that you really do not want to happen. Something that would be totally devastating to you if it took place. And different people shared something. Someone said death of their child, death of the mother, uncertainty about their spiritual life, about what God wants, etc. Fall from one's spiritual position to bloop, to deviate, lose association, fear of death, abandonment, fear of being abandoned by the spiritual mentor. So these are things. And then I did a little simple thing by then asking, what is one of the things, or one of the chief things that you had the greatest hope about or the greatest desire toward? And what we showed was basically the thing that you fear the most is also the thing that you are also thinking about in the sense of what you want to happen in a specific way. In other words, we were showing how this element of love and fear is some of the same energy, but it's a matter of a different channel. That things that's most important to us are the things that we want to happen and the things that we have the greatest fear or greatest disturbance if they don't happen. But now the danger in this is that the thing that we don't want to happen, as it is so much of a mantra in our consciousness, we do the opposite. Something that we have so much meditation, absorption on, we don't want to happen, we actually produce it or make it happen, because especially the subconscious mind, it doesn't pick up positive or negative, it just picks up the thing. And so if you're so much in a mantra about something in the subconscious, which is more powerful than the conscious mind, it then began to create situations, patterns to make just that you don't want to happen take place. You see that time and time again, people who keep experiencing some of the types of things in their lives, or people who have had some experience, somebody coming from a battered home, somebody's coming from abusive environment, somebody's come from some type of exploitation, and even though it's the last thing they want to see happen on in their life, because they're so much absorbed in the avoidance of that, or they've given their power over to it, then those exact things that happen. Same thing that happened to them by their father that they would never want to see happen. Now they become a father and they execute the same type of thing. Same type of situation that happened to them again and again in associations, in relationships. They don't want to happen. Then they find that just that thing comes forth in their life, and now they're in trouble. So this is mantra. And see, the mantra is significant because more important than what you say is what you think. More important than what you do is what you think. Because what you're really thinking is going to turn into ongoing habits and even into character. And so we can do many things, we can say many things, But what is going on in our internal dialogue, that's who we really are. And that's what's going to constantly come forth. You can be very intelligent, you can do amazing things, but in your mind, if you're telling yourself that you are useless, that you're worthless, that you are a low achiever, then gradually this will become you. Because it really is you. In the sense that it is your identity that you are holding on to. So then we talked about looking at certain types of fears. I think we asked you what comes to your mind when you think of fear. This is kind of one of some of the most extemporaneous things that come to your consciousness. We can see the whole list of all sort of negative concerns. But we tried to break it down also so that we could look a little closer at how the mind works. We want to see how the enemy works so we can see how to weed some of the unhealthy things out. And we showed how there are basically five different categories. Five strong established categories how anxiety, fear, grabs our consciousness. One is just a general anxiety, and some of the symptoms associated with that is nervousness, is tension, sometimes back pain, neck pain, etc. Weakness, bewilderment, forgetfulness. All of these things can have to do with general anxiety. But it's like, you know, you have to go and recite something in front of a group of people. You have to do some drama. And even though you know it, because you have so much anxiety, the mind just goes a little blank. Or you lose your equilibrium because of the anxiety. Now we look another type called panic. And the panic, another expression where fear is there and one gets panic attacks. And so that was the second category we discussed yesterday. The third was obsessive compulsion, where fear has become internalized and one is doing certain activities again and again and again with some sense of taking shelter of those unhealthy activities. Or phobias, fears that are not really warranted, but one is afraid of height, one is afraid of being boxed in, closed in, one is afraid the house is going to catch on fire. Something that just consciously absorbs the mind. It causes a person not to be loving, causes a person not to act what they can do. Post-traumatic stress fears. This is particularly due to some calamity, some abuse that's happened in someone's life, some very unfortunate experiences. And those experiences, they come back to haunt us from time to time. Now, our last two areas that we discussed in terms of major categories, we looked at worry. And this one is very important because it helps us to understand that we are in an environment, you say, padam padam yadvi padam natesham, that the material world is full of danger. So we're not to deny the duality of the danger. But the question is, how do we respond? No one can control the things that happen around them or even sometimes to them. But we all can control the response. We have the ability to control the response if we use that ability. So now worrying, some of the things that worrying does is worrying posits that we are powerless. Or worrying puts us in a mood of being powerless, as if we cannot make a change or do anything different. So we just worry. Worry is sometimes, excessive worry involves our being where we now put our energies into such, so without doing anything. So sometimes worrying is like a substitute or rationalization for not doing, and so now one feels, at least I'm worrying about it, so I'm concerned, I'm doing something, but no. So the mind energy goes into this, the theory, rather than being able to do the necessary. Worrying is also dangerous because when we are worrying, it can become so habitual that when there's time that there is genuine danger, we don't act in a proper way because we've already released all of our energies and mindset for things that are not really bona fide and legitimate. There are legitimate times when there's need to act in particular ways, but now one will not have the energy, the insight, the perception of the spiritual potency because it's all drained out based on unhealthy worrying. It usually has to do with the body anyway. Worrying, not depending upon God. Occupying the mind produces disease, waste of time, overindulgence. So this is a real tricky one. And when we just worry ourselves sick, we worry ourselves to death, or we worry because something is genuinely problematic. But instead of thinking what is the most loving action that can be done, then we just go into a powerless type of mindset or condition. And then last we talked about three ways of how we can respond to any situation of conflict, of crisis, of incoherence. First way is personal assertion, where you just literally think in terms of and involve yourself in that situation to try to make a difference. The second is to put yourself in someone else's shoes. Something is going on and it's problematic. Something is going on and there's some uncertainty. There's some incoherence. There's some difficulty. Now you just allow yourself to genuinely to try to think and act as if you were that particular person who is receiving whatever is going on, but instead of you being the one who's doing it or the one who's saying and looking at what you think, you're trying now to be that person and you're considering what happened or what I said, how now it is impinging upon me as that person. So you're in that person's shoes and now you're trying to think in the spirit of being that particular entity who has received or experienced something. You're not just being yourself, but you're being them. Many times some interesting resolution takes place because now you're able to look at this problem, this consideration, with a greater sense of clarity. And what's most important is that you can bring compassion. And the sadhus are supposed to be the servants of each other. They're supposed to be very caring. They're supposed to be param dukkha dukkhi kripam buddhi, feel the happiness of others, feel the sadness of others. That means they must constantly be empathetic or they're not proper sadhus. They're just thinking, this is what I feel, and this is what I want the person to do, and this is what should be done because this is the scripture, this is the rule of law, this is what is necessary. This is artificial. That is artificial. Because one is also to be able to genuinely to be so much concerned about others that a person can even put themselves in the other person's shoes, and you genuinely feel the pain when someone else is paining because you love them, and you feel the happiness when they're happy because you love them. And when they're bewildered, you're putting yourself in that situation to try to see what you can do to bring about some solace. And so many amazing times, one will be able to bring about a healthy solution because they have genuinely empathized with what is going on with the other person. Or so many amazing times, just by doing that, you can help the person because subtly or internally they will feel that you understand or that you care. There are many times when we do not help somebody because they really don't feel that we care. They feel that we are trying to instruct them, we're trying to correct them, but they don't feel that we care. Or they don't feel that we understand their pain. When people feel we understand their pain and we care, then it empowers them to move to the next step. Believe it or not, with all kind of psychotherapy and psychiatry, all different types of technology and all different types of schools, the number one variable that's most important is not the system, not the school, but it's the relationship between the therapist and the patient. The number one variable. Which means that whatever the person is saying to help that individual, if somehow a healthy relationship is not established, less likelihood it's going to work. And if the relationship is strong, then whatever technology is given, that the person can move themselves out of it more easier if, in fact, they're accepting that the one who's giving them the guidance really understands their pain and genuinely cares. Some of you who are managers in different ways, or will be managers, or will be leaders in so many different ways, it's important to know because people are really paining these days. One of the reasons I'm giving this kind of class, because people are so much now in pain and bewildered and fearing about all kinds of stuff, and have all kinds of blocks that interfere with their practices in spiritual life. They can go on 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, the rest of their life in some cases, and not make sufficient advancement, because in order to connect sufficiently with the higher scheme of things, we have to be sufficiently open to receive. Otherwise, you can chant and you can pray and you can do things so much, but if there's not sufficient potency to be able to benefit from what is there, then there'll be a problem. You can have somebody at your door, and if you don't let them in, doesn't matter what wonderful gifts they have for you, what we see. Doesn't mean that the gift is bad. Doesn't mean the process, anything wrong with the process. It means you haven't opened the door and let them sufficiently in. So, the last one is disassociate. And disassociation simply means that with assertiveness, well, we're just going right into the situation as ourselves. Second category, we're trying to be the other person. Disassociation, there are times when we have to just back away in body and in consciousness and just try to observe like at a distance what we are doing, what we're saying, what somebody else is saying, and just try to reflect on how this looks, what this means from what I am receiving, what I am doing, what someone else is saying, what they're doing. And sometimes just from that, it brings a person to a space where now they can try to do the right thing in the right way to get the most auspicious results from that. Or they can try to live the spiritual rule of law in such a way that it has greater potency. Or they can get around their own anarthas, their own false ego, someone else's ego. Or they can get around egos and see collapses. So many different things, but at a distance. So, in summary, that's some of the things that we were discussing yesterday, looking at the fact that you can't put fear and love in the same space, that God is not wanting us to be in fear, although we are totally surrounded with things that are anxiety-producing. Therefore, the question is, how such things come about? So sometimes we just have to be in a prayerful state, asking the Lord, please help me to see this differently. That I understand that you are not trying to put me in a bewildered state. You are not trying to put me in a harmful situation. You are not happy just to see me attacked or being bewildered, being abused physically, mentally, psychologically, whatever. And so this is going on. So I understand that nothing is happening by accident. But still, I am painting based on what is going on in my life. So either I have two options. I either have an option to think and look and consider you as being cruel, unkind, insensitive, biased, or whatever, because you put me in this situation, or you've allowed it to come upon me. Or I have a chance to try to see you as merciful, magnanimous, well-wishing, protective, and you've given me this encounter for some reasons that are for my advancement and my growth. But my pain is causing me not to be able to see it in any positive way. So therefore, I pray you help me to see it differently so that I can use it as needful, because you would not give me anything, allow something to come upon me just to weaken me, destroy me, to see me suffer. So when there's too much fear, Bhagavatam says it is they're doubting God. It is a fear, too much identification with the body. Kutobayo, it is having doubts and having fears in relationship to sometimes our own plans. That means we're trying to be too much of the controller. So because we're not ultimately the controller, we're trying to be too much of the controller, so we go into fear because our own plans are not manifesting. And so we are really angry with ourselves or disappointed with our own illusion of what we thought or think that we should be able to do. So now let me stop talking and let's see what things you might want to talk about, either from the class yesterday or what we shared just now, or some general points that you may have also in relationship to what you feel you would like to address or would like me to address to help you in your spiritual unfoldment. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think he wants to get it on the tape. 1 second.
Thank you. I was saying that I find in my case that there's a fear of uncertainty of God's plan for me, which comes about in...
Is it a little warm in here? Yeah. You see over the window or something over there?
Mm-hmm. My experiencing that maybe my definition of happiness or how the protection should come is not coming that way, but that I have to see it in a different way.
Yes, you said someone yesterday brought up one of their greatest fears is this fear of uncertainty. So sometimes our fear is that we are wanting something to happen in a very specific, particular way, and it is not happening, unfolding in that way that we feel that it should. And so the fear is that it is not coming the way that we expect. It's like we explained that we can take any negative sentiment or emotion and we can evaluate or see that as a cry for love. We can have enviousness, greed, anger, and we can either see all of those as just something negative and somebody's, emotions out of control, or we can look at this person and realize that this individual is also ultimately a loving entity, and that the force of love is greater than any other force on the planet or in the universe. And so therefore this is covered over love. So we try to see what is the love element that the cry is going out for. So anger, the cry is that one is feeling that they didn't get enough of the love, enough attention, affection, appreciation. Jealousy, somebody is feeling that the love that should have come to them went somewhere else. In other words, it's a matter of perception in such a way. But not just a mental gymnastics. It has to deal with really accepting certain premises. Understanding the soul is pure, but now covered over. Understanding that God is all-loving and is not giving us or doing something just to harm us or to hurt us or not being aware of what is going on. And so now something is taking place. We're uncertain because we're expecting it to happen a specific way and it doesn't. So sometimes that fear has to do with our misconception or our lack of sensitivity to what the Lord is arranging. We're thinking it's supposed to come this way, but it's already coming this way. And so we miss out. Another aspect of it is just the nature of the mind. The mind is conditioned to basically be a rascal. The mind is not our friend until we understand its tricks and put it under control. The mind has basically been the agent that has been mainly responsible for fulfilling the desires of the senses in their greed and in their avariciousness or in their desire to enjoy lower scheme of things. So basically, the body has been conditioned lifetime after lifetime to play the body game, to run after material gratification. And so the mind has been very active in being the major catalyst. When the senses are experiencing something in the environment, they want to do something, they work together, or in different ways, they send a message to the mind. And so most times the mind is locked in and controlled by the senses responding to the environment. Now when intelligence becomes stronger, because it's closer to the soul, then the intelligence is able to kind of cool the mind down so that the mind gradually controls the senses rather than being dragged by the senses. And so because the mind is so tricky, anyone who takes their mind too serious will be in constant anxiety. Anybody who's trying to be spiritual and is taking their mind too serious, when the mind is engaged in sankalpa vikalpa, it's picking things up, sometimes holding on to it, sometimes rejecting. Sometimes rejecting, sometimes picking up. Anybody who takes their mind too serious will have constant trouble in spiritual life and will gradually even fall away. So the mind will not stop. But if you stop taking the mind serious, and even though the mind is knocking, even though the mind is trying to entice, you're not giving it energy, and after a while, it just integrates and becomes a part of one's essence. It becomes kind of engulfed by the intelligence, by the soul. So we just have to come to a point also where we are not taking the mind so serious because it's picking up things from the environment, picking up things from our previous lives, picking up things from the immediate sensual stimulation. And see, this is one of the reasons people who have these kind of panics and these phobias is that they come to a point where they can't check the mind. Or why some people have serious mental illness. Because when the mind says, jump off that bridge, they can't control it. Or the mind says, you're going down this step to the subway, and the mind says, see a little lady in front of you, kick her. Watch her tumble. The mind can say things like that. But your intelligence says, no, not right. The mind says, see that woman? See, she thinks she looks real nice. She got a dress on just like yours. Slap her. And the mind says like that. And someone who's not controlling the mind, you know, some people, they can't distinguish. And they'll just do like that. You know? The mind says, just go in the middle of the street and just shout. You see, a mad person will do that. Or someone who's so-called sane, their mind is also sane sometimes, similar things, but they don't do it. Another person, the mind says, just go out in the middle of the street and just stop all the cars with your hand. The bus is coming, just stop it. The person's crazy and they try to. And so, the more that we are accepting the mind, the more we'll be unhappy and disappointed. But then how do we stop it? Or how do we do different if it keeps on feeding us? We have to control it by engaging it, and we have to trick it. Most important is to engage it. This is what I'll be talking about tomorrow at the farm. Is that there's important, it's very important for people to have goals. When you have vows, commitments, goals, then it harnesses the mind, and it allows it to go in a certain direction. And even though it gets pulled in so many ways, you've already put it under control for a while. So many times, spiritualists have trouble because they just have this big goal. I want to become a pure devotee. I want to become this. And that's the ultimate goal. But in reaching that ultimate goal, there's a need to keep the mind focused so that it can gradually make different levels of success and movement toward that ultimate goal. So when too often we are taking the mind too serious and we don't have goals, then what happens? We just get drifted here, there, and all kind of places. If we do not plan, Maya will plan for us. If we do not plan, Satan or ignorance will plan for us. So we either plan, use the mind energy, or we will be planned on. You see, so many devotees at the Wali just lose enthusiasm because they don't have any goals. Do not have projects. They do not focus their energies into something. And the mind is too strong. It's like a little child. Now, a little kid, it's very difficult. Here's this little kid here. For them to just sit like we're doing, it's very difficult. It's natural for them not to be happy, just be sitting. They want to do things. You just tell the child, just sit here. You got to sit there for 2 hours. Well, you sit him down, give him something to play with, give him something to eat, you engage him. He's all right for a while. So the mind is like that. You can't just tell the mind, just chill out. Just think of Krishna. No. The mind gets angry. Why? The mind gets disturbed. Even the more you try to engage in your spiritual life, the more you're giving attention to the intelligence and the soul, and that mind becomes angry, it becomes envious. It's like an entity, another entity. So it becomes envious, it thinks, I'm going to find ways to bewilder you. I'm going to find ways to get you back into making me the queen or the king. I'm going to find ways to get you into being a slave as you were of my demand. And so what happens, which really bothers spirits sometimes, is so many times the more you try to become serious, you try to commit, then the more the mind goes even wilder for a while. Because now it's seeing that you're moving out of its domain. But without, you know, ongoing harnessing of the mind, spiritual life is almost a joke. Because you just keep getting knocked down and beat up by the mind and its expert. Keep in mind, that same mind is not just the mind you have now, is 24 years old, or is 30 or 50 years old. That mind has been with you for many, many lifetimes since you've been in a material body. It's changed in different ways, but it's a part of your subtle body. So that mind knows you better than you know yourself at this particular lifetime. So that mind is going to bring up all kinds of tricks from your present, from from when you're a child and from other lifetimes. It's going to bring up all kind of things that it knows can imbalance you to bring you under control. This is what was meant by the mind is can be the greatest enemy or the greatest friend. Imagine somebody who knows you even more than you know yourself, and they have all kind of understanding of your weaknesses, and they're going to from time to time jump out on you based on those weaknesses. This is why Arjuna was saying that it's impossible to control the mind practically. But we can control it by the mind's controller. And that is by Krishna, that is by the soul, but we have to harness it so that it doesn't defeat us. So we'll talk more about that later, about the whole discussion of itself, about goals and aims, because that's often one of the biggest problems, especially with some of our younger devotees. Is that they go on in their spiritual life, or they're born in the movement, or they get out of the Gurukulas, or whatever, and they don't have any aims. They've just been hearing all the time you have to become a pure devotee. You become a pure devotee, you get all of these desires and all of these passions and all of these tendencies. It's got to go somewhere. It has to be channeled in some way. Yes.
What are some of the ways you can overcome procrastination in a general sense, which seems to be like the fear of not going ahead and doing what you need to do, and specifically procrastinating in spiritual life where it's easy for the mind to rationalize that if I maintain this process, I'll gradually make spiritual advancement, I'll become pure.
Hold it, this building is on fire. Let me get out of here, and once you're out, you start your mind going into different reflections or whatever. So sometimes it means that we're not taking the situation serious enough, the present situation sufficiently serious. And because of that, then we do not act. Sometimes it is due to the laziness that's associated with it. So because of such, then we think that we have a lot of time to do something because we do not see it as an emergency. This is why we see the great acharyas were always in the mood of becoming, never in the mood of being really relaxed. Haridasa, of course, thinking, if I don't finish chanting my mantras, my japa, you know, I'll fall. Jiva Goswami, they're always in the mood of where is Radha, where is Krishna? Always in that kind of anxiety. And we'll see this in the mood of the different prophets and the great saints. Because they're on a mission. And they are being mindful. And as they are so mindful, they are practically always with God because they are mindful of such. And based on that, they're making decisions and they're doing things in the consciousness of what would be pleasing to the Lord. And they know that the Lord is never pleased by just inactivity. But the action and the proper, and actions in the proper way. Other questions? Mm-hmm.
One of the goals we try to meet in this lifetime is to give unconditionally, or your love or whatever. If you do something for somebody, don't expect anything in return, not even a thank you. You do it because you want to do it, or because it's the right thing to do. But what if you're in a situation and you give, but it seems like you're not appreciated, or people take advantage of you because your attitude is, well, I just did this because I want to. Mm-hmm. And it makes it hard for you, and the mind says, leave this situation. Like, you know, they're just taking advantage of you. They, you know, they don't really care about you. And so, but you're torn. Like, well, I'm not supposed to feel that way. Can you be taken advantage of if you were giving unconditionally?
Interesting. Unconditionally means that you are always trying to say and do and interact based on what is necessary for the highest well-being of that person. Unconditionally doesn't mean to allow someone to abuse, misuse, exploit, and to manipulate you. That is conditional. Unconditional means that you're thinking, what is the best thing that I can do that will be the best thing also for this person. And so there are times when there's need to change the action because the person is doing something improper themselves based on what you're doing. And so therefore, by continuing, you're hurting that person because you're reinforcing some bad habit, some bad pattern. You are putting yourself in a position where they will karmically have to suffer for what they have done, the harm or the avoidance or whatever, that they are doing this improper. So you're really thinking about, what do I say and do that will be about the greatest good for this person? And so that is unconditional. Being concerned about the greatest well-being of that person. Now the action can change all kind of ways. Exactly. Because they'll use you and you're causing them to become habituated to doing the wrong thing. Because you're making yourself so accessible by giving or arranging. It's like sometimes the parent has to tell the child, look, if you are going to continue doing this, here you are 25 years old and you're coming into this house every other day drunk. You don't have a job and you're obnoxious, you're doing this, you're doing that. So sometimes the parents have to say, look, if you come into this house one more time like this, then you have a week to leave. And so, and although it may sound harsh, but it's putting the child in a situation where you are not accommodating their deviation. By allowing them to have a place to come, they don't have to work, eat anytime they want to, then come anytime they want, then you are reinforcing this bad lifestyle with good intention, but you're reinforcing it. So sometimes you have to do something that stops, that puts them in a situation where they have less likelihood, you know, to do this deviation. And that's a love. That's even a higher love. Yes.
How can I stop a negative thinking problem? I try to get somewhere. I get somewhere, but I can't really get rid of over it completely.
Like a little parable I was sharing yesterday. And there's a parable with the Native American Indians. As they explore the mind, and the parable is, in my mind, I have an evil dog, and I have a good dog, and they're always fighting. And the question is, who wins? And the understanding is, the one I feed the most. The one I feed the most, give the most attention to, is strongest, and will defeat the other. So the negative thoughts, as we feed them and feed them, they get stronger and stronger. Or as we even try to avoid them from our consciousness, they get stronger and stronger because we're still watering them. But as we put more attention and energy to the positive, then what happens is that that mind energy goes in that direction to where it's less and less energy to go in any other place. It's just like a bad habit, you know? You just try to stop the bad habit because you know it's bad. And you're thinking every few days or every few hours, I gotta stop this, I gotta stop this. It doesn't happen like that so easily. Very weird, almost never. But as you realize it is unhealthy, and now you're able to replace that with something else, now the energy goes in a different way, and after a while, you have moved away from that particular habit. So now the way we think differently is that we have to have different stimulation. Sometimes we have to be in different environments than the previous environments that cause us to think unhealthily. Sometimes we have to be more careful about what we're eating, what we're hearing, what we're seeing, so that what the mind is grabbing hold to will be different. You try to think differently, but you keep putting the mind grabbing hold to the similar things, it will give you a similar response. Because it's picking up and it's eliminating. So if we want to become freed of unhealthy thoughts, don't just beat ourselves that we're having these thoughts. Don't go into so much lamenting that they're there. Realize that this is what the mind does too. It's picking up sometimes from other people's thoughts, from the environment, from previous life, also from fears. And now you want to allow that energy to be more connected with something that is positive so that now it's occupied and it doesn't go to that other space. Other questions? Like the example of the child. You tell the kid to sit down for a few minutes and he'll start crying, he'll start tearing the wall up, he'll do something because he just needs to be active.
But if you give the kid something to play with, something to draw, you occupy him, he's okay for a while.
Mm-hmm. We should be able to access our love by getting rid of fear. But in the Gita, Krishna suggests to Arjuna that he should meditate on the fact that death is certain. So is that a sense...
Does that provide good fear, or fear of death?
It provides good action. Like with the worrying we put on the board, or the worrying that the house is, the restaurant is on fire. So you meditate that you can die any moment. You meditate that death is inevitable. And so based on that, now you guide your actions based that that is a possibility that will happen sometime. And so you are doing the most essential thing and being accountable, realizing that this is something that will come about. Doesn't mean that one just goes into a mode of fear and bewilderment and non-activity or procrastination. No, it means this is a reality. Now your actions should be in correspondence to this as a reality. Like that. Okay, maybe we'll take a few more questions and then we'll stop. I'll be driving back to Harrisburg tonight. Yes, go ahead.
When I was evaluating this whole last night, I was thinking that all the fears that I have ultimately come from a lack of faith. Mm-hmm. And I guess partially it's because I guess when I evaluate my life, you know, I surrender a certain portion fully to God, but then I'm holding back a certain portion to myself. And that portion that I'm not surrendering, that's the actual I'm trying to hold on to. I'm trying to secure that, you know, by myself. And I understand philosophically and through the scriptures that we're supposed to be fully selfless, but I still struggle with actually giving up those attachments. You know, whether thinking about your future, thinking about your retirement,
mm-hmm.
Even just the general fear of death. Philosophically, it makes sense to me. Okay, the soul cannot be burned, it cannot be withered by the wind, like that. But yet at the same time, when certain situations occur, I don't necessarily think along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with having to think about the body and the mind, because it does need, it's also its nourishment and its care. It's not that we go into denial and consider that we're spiritual beings. Therefore, because we're spiritual entities, we don't have to worry about hygiene. We don't have to worry about finance. No, we want to deal with those things to the best we can so that we don't have to put so much energy into it. They are secondary. But we want to take care of them so that we can have more time and energy for the primary. So don't think that it's something bad about having to reflect on those issues and that it's a sign of a lack of faith. No, not necessarily. Just that you just have to be able to prioritize a little better and give the secondary things proper attention so you can do them, move away from it, and be able to have more energy into the primary. So sort of similar to what I was saying is that you have the social activist and you have the spiritualist, and sometimes they're like opposite polarities. One just wants to do and make changes in the social and political arena. The other just wants to do the inner life. It's necessary for us to do the inner life in such a way that it makes changes. And so this marriage is healthy. So similarly, we don't want to be so spiritual that we're in denial about the environment and assisting others and being relevant. Or do we want to be so material that now this has become our God? Money, prestige, fame, adoration, or whatever. Still, the issue is a point issue, is that when our faith is weak, it becomes hard for us to, you know, to dive deeper in our spiritual awareness. But we want to dive deeper in our spiritual awareness while we're also being aware of what that means in the social, economic, you know, political scheme also. You know, this is particularly the mood of present day, you know, dispensation for spiritualists. It's not the time or not the age where people just go to the mountains, to the bush, to the cave and meditate. and they're okay. It's the time for people to be able to be in environments and still maintain a sense of chastity, potency, purity, etc., while they grow and share it, you know, with others. Any other last questions? Now we have a question. Yeah, the middle.
Sometimes when, because I find myself, if I'm not properly fearing, almost that I seem to lose concentration. I mean, that may be an admission to not being very spiritually advanced, but I find that sometimes if there's not consequences to my actions, that there's a tendency to be a lot more lenient, not more focused on my particular service. That without the understanding that, okay, I must perform this every single day, or bad things are going to happen, not just to me, but to other people. And without that understanding, I have a tendency to become deviant.
Well, that's the same thing as the idea of doing the lesson because the teacher may fail you, or doing the job because if you don't, you know, you may get fired, or, you know, doing your part, you know, within the romance because of something that you want, and if you don't do that, you won't get what you want. So that's a certain level of a relationship, but it's also a superficial level, because it means that what you're really doing is you're just arranging based on what you want to receive, and so everything is propositioning because of what you want. And you can't have love just based on one's own experience. Love is very dynamic, and it involves relationship and it involves sharing. It's not just a matter of seeing how you can get things from other people, and so therefore you have to do something in order to get something. This is the idea of the fearing of God rather than the loving of God. I think I gave that story once of how we were trying to see many years ago if President Rawlings was using some of the books that we were giving him. And so the devotees were kind of watching things he was saying in his speeches and kind of study his life a little bit. And so at one point there was a problem in the country, and then the president of that country, Ghana, he called the spiritualists together, different leaders of different spiritual organizations, and he chastised them. And he said, the problem is that you're all talking and preaching about fearing God rather than loving God. And the devotee's eyes went up. Oh, you see, he's reading the books. Reading Prabhupada's books, you know. Because it emphasizes the higher expression is not just to fear, no, but to love. So when you're just doing something based on fear, it's still so much centered about your own thing that you want, or your own sovereign interest. It's not so much directed toward the beloved. And so in some cases it doesn't quite kick in because it's not directed toward the beloved. So, but that is a phase of loyalty and commitment. We do things out of duty. But if it's only out of duty, after a while we won't even continue. This is why you see often too people on spiritual paths, and they're doing things for so many years, and then at some point they just lose enthusiasm because it's more out of duty. That this is what they're supposed to do, and so they're doing it. But if somehow a taste isn't developing, an understanding, somehow some love isn't there, then not only will we not be able to do it, but we'll even become angry about what we're doing. See, it happens sometimes. I mean, I saw it so many times, you know, many years ago, before I started working again here in America, and before Africa, I was in Eastern Europe, communist countries, and then before that I was traveling in a lot of places to monasteries and to some scholars who were interested in Eastern books, religion, philosophy. And so it would take us many, many times all over the world to nunneries where nuns lived, and to monasteries where priests. And we would be shocked sometimes to see the number of monks and priests who were atheists. And many of them were like 75, 80 years old. And so they were still living in the monastery because they had joined at 20, had joined at 25, joined at 30 years old. It was their life. It was their profession. But after a while of getting up early in the morning, eating, in some cases they were very austere, like the Trappists, they just eat a little soup and a little bread. And in the early days, they wouldn't even talk, you know, they didn't socialize. They just, you know, just do their work, and they spend most of their time in silence, in contemplative prayer. And some of them, after many years, they would be so angry. They would hate the abbot, and they would hate God. I mean, I had times of going into some of their rooms. And first on the room, first you would see why they were angry, one of the reasons. Because here they were celibates, and they had all these naked pictures on the wall. So there's like an anger that why they're not enjoying. So they only enjoy with their eyes. Or maybe play funny games with themselves. The other thing was that sometimes they would say, just look, I've been in this monastery for 55 years. And what do I have? Here I'm sleeping in this little closet. Huh? They have a one room, you know? Sometimes like a dormitory. Or attached, you know, bathroom that many people use. And it would say like this. Sometimes you would see the naked ladies, pictures, and you would see alcohol. And you feel sorry because you realize here's somebody who was trying to approach God, and it didn't quite work for them because they didn't quite work properly. But this is what they know, and they're locked in. And so now they're hating themselves, hating their institution, feeling that God tricked them or God doesn't exist. And now they're just sitting back, feeling angry that they didn't get married when they were 20 or 30 years old. Now they're 80 years old. Nobody even wants them. They're a failure spiritually and a failure materially. Huh? And even now, even if they wanted to have children, they can't. And they're just getting drunk. And I had one was so disturbed. He said, look, son. I think I was only about 23 years old, around that time, 24. He said, look, son. He says, we got 3 minutes to finish this conversation. He said, because if I don't get down there in the cafeteria in the next 5 to 10 minutes, there will not even be any food for me. Even though I've been here for 45 years. So he was angry. He was, you know, just angry about the lifestyle, angry about the austerities, angry about, you know, the institution, angry about unity and conformity. Because he had involved himself in something, perhaps without understanding the depths of it, but also with certain kind of expectation, and, you know, who knows what else. But in the process, he become hard-hearted. So sometimes people can engage in austerity and become hard-hearted if it's all about just the ritual, and somehow the mind is not being controlled, then it becomes the ritual, then that same ritual they begin to hate. But then they're locked in because it's like, you know, where am I going to go now? And so we've seen so many people like this. And I've seen nuns in the same way. I mean, I have never been in a place, and I've traveled all around the world, all kind of environments. I've never been in a place where I felt so filthy by being sexually desired than being in some place with a few nuns who were cheaters or who were angry like some of these priests. Because sometimes we were going to these cloister places where only people were coming were other priests. And because we were having spiritual books, we were allowed to come in some of the environments. I remember a couple of times being in a room with a nun who was, you know, teaching a course on comparative religion, and I couldn't wait to run out there. I thought she was gonna rape me. It was like so intense. And I was just feeling so sad. Later I can understand. Here was somebody who had spent years and years and years of so-called chastity, but the mind and the body wasn't quite in tune. So even though the actions were stopping, that the desires were so strong, and it's becoming more and more suppressed, and then the anxiety and the intention and the lust is just pouring out of one's, you know, one's being. So that can happen. And that's one of the reasons why you're finding now more and more, they're finding in all the various orders, they're finding so much child abuse, so much homosexuality, because of what's happening is that people are repressing rather than channeling. And especially the sex energies are very, very strong. Because they're very powerful and they're very creative and it's natural. And so what's happening now, we're finding, yeah, the report was a couple of years ago that 1/3 of the priests in England are homosexual. And I'm not homophobic or whatever. I'm not trying to attack any particular group, but just talking about lifestyle. In England, 1/3 of the priests are professed homosexuals. And that's those who somehow, you know, report it of such. Because what it means is that in so many of those environments, the desires are not sufficiently channeled, and it's got to go someplace. When I was in Nigeria, Ivory Coast, about 1/3 of my lectures were in to monks, Catholic priests, nuns, on celibacy and reincarnation. And you would just get hundreds, and sometimes we got almost 2,000 people coming. And you start talking about celibacy, it's like ears would go up, because everybody was wanting, hey, this stuff don't work. This doesn't work. Let's see what this guy from his order, what he had to say about it, you know. But it all has to do with repression rather than genuinely releasing with love and channeling it into other areas. So it's natural the mind will be disturbed if it's not sufficiently harnessed and channeled. Let's take one last question, and then I think we had better stop. Okay.
How is it that one thing that's sufficient time? How is it that one who has spent sufficient time, like in devotional service, how is it that they can now move on to the next ashram, in which they have to provide a little more for like a family situation? How is it that they channel, say like a career, and still feel like that they're fulfilling their original goal, their original plan, without just doing a career just to support the family, but actually to start a career and actually be able to stay online with their spiritual goals.
Yeah, listen to your words. How can they maintain fixing their consciousness when they have to support a family? you play that tape back when they have to, you know, do this thing. So first they should stop thinking that supporting a family is something bad, that it's some burden or something, you know, or that it's a distraction from that it's an inherent distraction from spiritual life. Matter of fact, we're all in some kind of relationship. It's a matter of what the name of it, what the quality of it is. We all have some accountability to others. Now, if we consider that our family is a part of our devotional service, an integral part, and the most important part of our devotional service, because the family is literally the microcosm of the institution of the planet. What happens in the family determines what is going on ultimately in the country. You know, we have strong families, and you have strong environments. And weak families, and weak environments. So, you consider that as your previous activities were about preaching, learning, and preaching, preparing yourself, and serving. And so, should that change? So now, you have family to prepare, to work together, and then to try to share what you have amongst yourself with others. So you should see that your first devotional service is being a loving father, husband, who is spiritually astute and who is acting as a guide, so that as your wife and child see you as their first guru, they can see you with zeal and appreciation, and that you will be distinctly taking care of some souls who are under your immediate care, while you're thinking about how to save the city, the country, the world, etc. or the universe. Lord Brahma would say, hold a minute, you better take care of your family first. Then you can have my position, maybe.
The second part of that question is, how is it that you choose something, like a career that's actually part of your dharma.
Mm. That's where you have to look close at yourself, and you can also be in consultation, of course, with senior god brothers and with your spiritual masters. As you honestly express some things that you feel more inclined toward, and then you try to see how you can do that and offer that for taking care of your family, and offer that, you know, to Krishna. I mean, obviously Krishna's not going to accept some deviation. He's not going to accept that you're choosing to take a career as a bank robber. And he's just going to offer the money to Krishna, take good care of my family. But of course that's a sinful activity, because you'll be, you know, doing things that's unhealthy. But if you have particular interest in some area, and if you can genuinely be able to do that and offer that, you know, as taking care of your family and as a service, you know, to the Vaishnavas and to the world, then that's good. See, at the end of the day, Krishna, God doesn't care so much about what work you do, as long as it's not sinful, or where you work, or where you serve. After all, every place is his place. But he cares about what's going on in your consciousness, what you're doing. Now, obviously, when you're in a project, we as managers want to keep you in that project as much as possible. Because the idea, one, out of concern about monitoring you to help you, out of concern about that project growing, but ultimately the major interest should be what is best for your Krishna consciousness. So sometimes it gets a little confusing, because we may put the project more important than the people who are involved in the project. So as managers, we have to always be a little careful. As we're confronting someone, we have to think what is first best for this person, as we think about what is best for so many people based on the project. And that's a juggle. But it's something we have to work on a lot more. And if we do that, then people will feel so much more empowered to do whatever they have to do, and they'll be more loyal about what they have to do, because they'll feel that there are others who are, cheering them on, praying for their well-being, giving their blessings. See, sometimes devotees who venture into certain areas, then they really go far into deviation, because they kind of feel nobody really is ready to support or trust them anyway, or nobody cares about them, or they consider, everyone thinks I'm in Maya, so I should be in Maya. Everybody thinks that now that I'm married and I got 3 kids, I'm probably at home watching television all day, maybe on the weekends drinking a beer, so they think that way, so I might as well do it. After all, so many people's thinking couldn't be wrong. And then, you know, and you lose a certain amount of strength and determination. So there was a time when the Krishna Conscious Organization was so focused on the sort of monastic lifestyle, or so focused on the temple as the all in all, that when someone did decide to go off into a career, it was as if they were becoming a second-class citizen. And so there was a time when that was either conscious or unconsciously kind of, you know, transmitted. So then a lot of people didn't, you know, act upon some responsible things they could do for their family, or didn't embark upon, you know, careers, or didn't take, you know, certain kinds of risks that, you know, could have been healthy. But I think and hope that those days are quite gone. But now there's the issue of manpower shortage or woman power shortage. And so many projects, the idea is trying to keep people in the monasteries, in the temples, because of a shortage of manpower. But while we do have to maintain the temples, because the deities are there, at the same time, we have to be very sensitive to what's going on with, you know, each person. Otherwise, then people will leave, and they'll leave with, like these priests, they'll leave with anger and disgust. And they'll feel that they've been just used and not really taken care of. So it's a simple thing. But last point, but just try not to think in terms of that it is a burden that you have been given a nice partner. It's a burden that you've been given a nice child. See it that, oh, how wonderful that Krishna has allowed me to be able to procreate where I can bring forth and take care of a soul. How wonderful that Krishna has given me a partner that we can share and work together to struggle together in our Krishna consciousness. How wonderful Krishna has given me someone who can help protect me. How wonderful Krishna has given me someone that I can help protect. We think about it in this way as an immediate service. So then let's summarize in 2 minutes. So the whole thing we've been talking about is you can't have love and fear simultaneously, that one is going to overcome the other. And that fear really is perverted love, or like lust is perverted love. And so we have the ability to decide how we're going to tune in. We can get very captured by what's been going on now on the planet, that constant acceleration of fear, where people are so much not being able to express themselves with their full sense of creativity, with their fullness of love, because they are shutting down due to insecurities, due to combative type of mentality, due to anxieties about the future. So they're allowing some of those anxieties to become dominant and to actually happen, but often being so, you know, so afraid. So while this culture of fear and anxiety is developing in America and all around the world, and will bring more fragmentation, bring more sickness, it'll bring more chaos and confusion, more pandemonium, that there should be some people in various parts of the planet who are focusing on waging peace and waging love. While the sinister elements are doing their role, that there should be those who are helping to counteract that, so they make a difference with themselves and in their families, and hopefully with, you know, within their community. And in this way, we will not just be swamped up by what's happening to the general mental culture on the planet. So we gave you some of the things, some of the kind of anxieties that's developing due to the type of fears, you know, that's taking place. We looked at some of our own greatest fears and realized that it's the opposite of what we really want to happen. We looked at 3 ways of how to kind of consider different things, different levels or different, you know, ways of perception. And so keep those in mind. Sometimes do involve yourself and think how you can act in the most loving way at that given time. Sometimes try to analyze situations from someone else's polarity or position, being in somebody else's shoes and trying to see how you can understand them so that you can be more of an assistant or to complement their particular concern. And then sometimes just back away from the whole scheme of things, having more faith in God and realizing that nothing is happening by accident, and then see what can you do now based on what the variables in fact are. And even if you make wrong decisions or decisions that are not the best at that time, if the consciousness is in the right place, then the Lord will do the rest. Because as we have the right desires, then it becomes the duty of the Supreme to facilitate us based on our genuine desires. And that should give us a lot of solace in knowing that we're all being called in, that facilitation is always there, that that is what our original nature is, that we have now put on hold for a while. So now we want to stop procrastinating, stop interfering, stop denying the call, and move a lot faster with the help that is always there. As we have the fear, and even though the call is there, even though the help, we'll keep turning away from it. As we lose the fear, then it means we remove those barriers or enemies of the mind that are based on the fear. So more and more people will become sinful because of the fears. What they will do as they're trying to struggle for survival like animals, or how they attack others based on thinking that they have to destroy or annihilate someone because of what they may impose on them, then you get this tremendous kind of storm of lower conscious activities, lower thoughts, speaking, and then actions. So we're at war now, and it's accelerating. And the question is, do we find ourselves as casualties, or will we find ourselves becoming more fortified so that we can not only take care of ourselves but be able to help others? There are going to be so many people in all kind of communities who are going to need so much help. And if you're too wounded, you're not going to be able to help anybody. You won't be able to even help yourself very much. But if you can keep yourself more fit, then when such people who will come around you, because the Lord will send them if you are strong enough to deal with it, then you can be able to help them, and as you help, you will grow. Because in spiritual life, you grow so much based on how you use what you have. So just see this as not just some seminar, or lecture, or workshop, but as a chance for us to touch together, heart to heart, mind to mind, about preparing ourselves from some storm that's going on. Thank you very much.